what are your habits? What is your morning routine? Or what is your night routine? So if you're burning all of these calories on stage, how are you refeeding? How do you feel about the current structure, the system of education? You know, what is that master key that unlocks everybody's heart? I'm so happy to speak with you.
Thank you.
You know, I consider you like a, I don't know if you know the Buddhist concept of a bodhisattva.
Yes, I do.
You know, somebody who comes back over and over to until the all beings are awakened and enlightened and liberated. Like, that's what I consider you, man, because you...
You're a little too kind. I didn't want all beings to be awakened. I don't know how many times I've been here.
You've chosen it, man. What I really love about what you do is it's not in isolation, right? I think you have a holistic viewpoint in helping people. You know, I always use the analogy when a baby is developing, it doesn't just develop the arm and then the leg, like everything happens together. And we are a holistic organism. And I love, you know, so you speak about, you know, food, finance, you know, your Earth Day, climate, you know, everything, because I think that's the best way to really elevate the human experience, you know, in a holistic sense. Yeah.
Well, and by the way, I'm not just throwing smoke your way. I like your eloquence and your heartfeltness, and honestly, your uniqueness. Like, you create your own messages. I really respect you for that. So many people just knock off somebody else's stuff and say it and call it their own. You couldn't be more opposite of that. But also, the heartfeltness in your message is what really touches me. There's a kindness. There's a compassion. There's a love of humanity that I feel in you that I think was what makes us kind of brothers on the path.
Yeah. You know, for me, I try to speak the language, you know, I try to, like you said, distill a message in a way that all ears can receive it, you know, no matter what part of the fence you're on, you know, you can get it, because I feel what comes from the heart reaches the heart. And I try to like approach my bigger videos with the mindset of death. Right. Like I try to think, OK, if this is the last piece that I'm ever going to do and that's it, what do I say? Yeah. And I think that's what you're feeling, you know, that compassion, that kindness, that love, because that's the only message I think worth saying.
Yeah. You know, I agree with you.
You have death in mind. Yeah.
That really touches my heart, brother. When you say that, I can flash on a few videos I've seen of yours and I feel the feeling all over again. You're just, and now I have another piece of it, though. You have that sense of urgency underneath it as well. You know, this is the last one I'm going to do. Like, I feel that in you. I have that too. I don't know why. I've had that my whole life. I've had it since I was a little kid. Like, the sense of make every minute count, and you got to serve, because what else is there, right? You never know when you're going to go. So that touches my heart to hear that that's your belief structure behind it all. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, for sure. Never know when you're going to see your last sunset. Well, you mentioned you. I'm so curious. I'm interested in you, selfishly. I'm curious about, you know, your habits, what created you. You know, they say in the first 30 years of life, we make our habits. And then in the next 30, our habits make us. Yeah. Well, what are your habits? What is your morning routine? What is your night routine? Something that a lot of people don't speak about.
Oh, it's interesting. Nobody ever asked me about the night routine, and it's equally important. First of all, I think what drives me is what I see drives you. It's just heart, right? I just love people. When you're just sharing me earlier before we started here about what drives you, it brings tears to my eyes, because I know it's true about you and it's unique and sincere. So when there's a hunger to serve, that colors everything. It colors how you do what you do, colors why you're willing to do the crazy things you do. My regimens are insane. You know, I'll give you a couple simple ones, but to give you a perspective, you know, I do an event, as I think you know, it's, you know, I've got 10, 15,000 people now virtually. It's actually bigger. But I got to hold a stadium for 12, 14 hours a day for 4 days in a row or 7 days in a row. And it's just me. You know, it's like you go to a concert, and the great concert after 3 hours, people are usually done, right? You know, so it's like to be able to do that requires a level of physiology. So I have to condition my body, my mind, my emotions, and my spirit. If I leave any one of those out, because the body and the spirit are tied together. I don't know if you've ever woken up and thought, like, let's go get them. And your body goes, I can't get out of bed. You know what I mean, it's just like, you got to make sure they're all together. Because when I'm on that stage, we've measured everything. And I use this $68,000 device they use for these top athletes in the world that measures their heart rate variability. They're coming in doing my blood and my saliva and all that stuff. Yeah. To give you an idea, on one day on stage, you know, 13, 14 hours, I burn 11,300 calories. 8,000 is on stage. 4,000 is before I start. Right? Okay. I'm just under 4,000. And they've done it 5 events because they couldn't believe it. I found out the chess masters, they brought this to me, will burn 4,000 doing no movement because of the level the mind is engaged. So that's what happens to me before I get on stage. And then I do the equivalent of a marathon on stage. I do 18 miles on the first day to 21. On the third day, I do 26 to 28 miles. Just getting around the building, being connected to people, doing what they're doing. So when you're doing something of that kind of intensity, you have to be prepared physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. So, and you can't prepare that day alone because that day, I mean, up until this last year, 2020 anyway, you know, my average schedule will be 118 cities, 116 cities usually, you know, 16 or 18 countries, some of them 2 and 3 times. So you got to do it all the time. So here's my answer to your question. One, I start with a psychological, physical piece, which is I jump in this cold plunge first thing in the morning, always. I'm fortunate enough to have multiple homes. In my home in Sun Valley, I walk through the snow in the winter and I drop into the water there. The water there is usually about 39 degrees. And my other places, it's 56. I jump in not only because it moves your lymph and your blood like nothing you've ever experienced, because the brain's going, oh my God, I might die. It sends blood to every part of your body. So it's a cleansing experience but all, and a rejuvenation experience. But also it's the psychological component of training myself that I don't negotiate with myself ever. The biggest challenge I hear when people are talking to me is like, well, I really want to do that, but I'm not ready, or I need more information, or, and I know for a fact that the most successful, let's say, investors in the world, they all have to make decisions like any great leader without perfect knowledge. If you wait to have all the information, the opportunity is gone. So what I've trained myself to do is when I say go, we go. I don't have, I don't have a morning I can remember where I was like, oh, I can't wait to jump in the cold water. I don't think there's ever happened. But every day I walk up that thing and I don't go 1, 2, 3. I don't go, let me think about it. Let me get ready. I don't go, I'll do this later in the afternoon. I just do it.
Wow.
So that simple discipline is so good for my body, but it's also good for my mind because it creates the habit you're talking about, which is when I say go, we go. There's no discussion within myself. And most people, I found, tend to negotiate with themselves. I know I used to decades ago. And it's one of the biggest things I changed at a very young man. And then I just strengthen it with some of these habits. Second, I then do a form of meditation. I don't really think it was meditation. Most people's idea of meditation is not thinking, which good luck. But what I do is prime. And priming is a very simple principle. I'm sure you know, Prince, but just so your audience understands, you know, most of us think we're having a thought. We're having that thought consciously ourselves. When in reality, and I'm not even talking about like COVID and the stuff you see every day and being told a certain thing until your brain hears enough repetition, you believe it. I'm just talking about the environment constantly shapes what we're thinking about when we think it's our own original thought. I'll give you one quick example, then I'll tell you how I balance this to make sure it's right. So Harvard did a study, and in America, there's a significant part of the population that believes that people that are Asian do better on math scores and science scores, and that females do not as well. Now, this has no truth whatsoever, meaning if you take an average person with the same background and training, whether female or Asian or any other gender or any other culture, it doesn't matter. But it is true in the Asian culture that, as a generalization, families train kids that you have to be prepared, you have to do your homework. It's part of the cultural upbringing around the value of education that is not equal in every culture in the United States. Females have been told they don't have this skill set outside, and it's total bullshit. But because we believe it, it affects us. So they decided to do a study on priming, and not only priming of the culture, but priming of what happens right before you take a test. And so right before the SAT test, they took a group of Asian women. And think about it. They have two different cultural conditionings. One is, I'm Asian, I'm going to do well on math. The other is, I'm a woman, I don't do as well on this. And the test was very simple. All they did was ask one question right before the test, and it was different. And the effect on the testing results were across the board mind-boggling. They asked, what is your gender for one half of the group? And the other graph, they asked them, what is your ethnicity? And guess what? The people that, the women that were asked, what's your gender, scored 20% lower than the ones that were asked, what's your ethnicity, 20% higher. That big a jump from one question.
Wow.
So I don't wake up in the morning always feeling wonderful. Like when people ask me all the time, well, you know, don't you have bad days? You know, the media for 25 years, 30 years, they ask me a question like, you know, don't you have days when you wake up in the morning and feel lousy and you just want to watch TV and eat Cheetos and watch porn? And I say, I do some of those things, right? You know, but the bottom line is, of course, I have bad moments, bad times, but I, like an athlete, I've trained myself to get the hell out of it. It's like building a muscle.
Yep.
So what I do is prime myself for what I want. Mm. If I want my life to be in prime time, I don't hope I'm going to feel good in the morning. I might wake up, I got 3 hours sleep, I got to get on stage, my body's hurting. Yeah. You know, I can't afford to let that affect the day. I got to serve.
Yep.
So I do what I do to my body. Mm. Second piece I do is my mind. And I do what I call priming, and it has three simple steps. And your team, I'm going to tell it to you now, your listeners, but if they want to like get a video walking them through in case they forget, you go to TonyRobbins.com/priming. It's free, and they'll just send it to you. What I do is I start out with a change in my physiology, which is a breathing pattern. And you're probably familiar with the breath of fire, where you're exploding breath in and out through the nose. And I do that for, you know, 30 reps, three times. And that changes the body. Now I'm in a great state. Plus, I just jumped in the water. Now I do three things for just 10 minutes. 10 minutes total, because I tell people, you don't have 10 minutes for your life, you don't have a life, right? So I go 3 minutes and a third, roughly. I think of three moments in my life I'm super grateful for. And I try to mix it up with big things and little things. So I appreciate the little things too. And I don't just think about it. Like if I asked you what was like on the roller coaster and you remember yourself on a roller coaster over there, it's different than if you remember going over the seat, right? So yep. I make myself get associated in my body, see, hear, feel that moment I was so grateful for. It could be something as powerful as, you know, I just had a fifth child, my daughter here at 61. I can't even believe it. And then one of the greatest gifts, or I can think of like the wind on my face outside by the ocean, even if I'm not there, what that feels like to me. And so as I go through and feel those, it's stacking the gratitude, which may sound corny, but all the research now shows that gratitude is the one emotion that deals with the two negative patterns all humans have, anger and fear. A decision made out of fear is almost always the wrong decision, in my experience. You can't be grateful and fearful simultaneously. You can't be angry and grateful simultaneously. So I train myself every day. And what that does is it increases the wiring in your brain till it becomes a pattern even when you're not doing it, right? And so that's number one. Number two, I take 3 minutes real fast and I imagine God, the universe coming through, cleansing my body, healing every cell, every nerve, body, making me the best human I can be, bringing out my strength, my boldness, my love, my compassion, all those things. And then after about a minute and a half of that, I imagine that coming into my heart and then sending that to my children, to my family, to my friends, to my coworkers and associates and partners, and to anybody I have the privilege of meeting. And that may sound corny, but research was done with the Dalai Lama on neuroplasticity and compassion, the caring and sending out the love to others rewires your brain. Also, there's a scientific basis to everything I'm doing. Yep. And then the third piece, so I've done 3 minutes, 3 minutes, the last 3 minutes, three and a third, three and a third. I call three to thrive. And that's where I focus and say, okay, what are three results that I want to produce? And they can be short-term or long-term, but I want to see, feel, and hear it. Not like I'm going to, what I'm going to do to make it happen. Like it is done. I know you know how the brain works. When the brain perceives that it's done, it finds the way to make it happen. But I add to that the emotion of celebration. Mm-hmm. And so, and then I'm done. And I'm set for the day. Then it varies on the day, but every day I lock out, and it's usually right before a meal, I'll read 30 minutes. I learned that from my teacher, Jim Rohn. And I don't read what comes to me on my phone. I don't read clickbait. I'm talking about something that's valuable, something that I perceive to be can add value. Actually, I usually read books, but I read this amazing article about electricity and how they're able to take like flatworms and grow two heads, how are you able to regenerate? Like you and I can regenerate our liver. A child up to 7 days old can lose a finger and will grow back. But what is that tool underneath that? And how can science use that to create rejuvenation? So that to me is much more interesting than reading one more article about COVID and we're all going to die when, you know, the science may show something very different in the first place. So yeah. I do that. Then my evening regimen, I'll shut the hell up, is long description. It changes all the time. But the core of it is I want time with my family. And if I'm overseas, I still find that time where we do it through internet connection, through the iPhone and so forth. But then what I try to do at the end of the night, and I only started this recently because I'm doing this book on life force. And it's like all the best tools in regenerative medicine, things that are coming that people think would be 30 years from now, like a single injection that's coming out next year. If you have osteoarthritis, it regrows all your tendons and ligaments in 10 to 12 months. And they're like, if you're 60 or 70 or 80, they're like 16-year-old ligaments. It's not bullshit. It's phase three trials right now. It's gone through safety. It's gone through effectiveness. Now it's effectiveness at scale. And then it'll get approved. Just amazing stuff. Wow. And so one of the things I came across, which is really fundamental, I heard about, is the power of a sauna. But what I didn't know is how it works and what it does. And what's interesting is 20 minutes a day, four times a week, and you reduce your cardiovascular risk of dying by more than 50%. It's mind-boggling. But what's really interesting is the science now shows that the heat itself, it's not just sweating, it's not just getting your heart rate up. The heat itself creates these heat shock proteins. Shock
proteins, yeah.
Yeah, and they go in, you sounds like you know a little bit about it, and they change the way the cells fold, the shape of the cells, which creates the function of the cells. Anyway, long story short, it's so rejuvenating. And for me, I'm a guy that, like, I don't sleep a lot. And so I know I got to, because I did this book on all these tools, and I went through all these super high-tech things, and then I went to the basic things, like sleep. I was like, holy shit, you know, there's a $1.6 billion test that we do every year, and it's when we do, you know, daylight savings time. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but when we do daylight savings time, when we do the piece where we lose the hour, we have 25% more heart attacks in the next 7 to 10 days. Mm. And when we put it back, we drop by 23 to 25%. It's the reverse. I'm like, holy shit, I sleep, you know, 4 hours, you know, 5 hours a night. So I started doing the sauna, and I found I'm able to stay asleep because I do it at the last part of the night. So I do my reading. I'm in there. I'm laying out the day. I'm recapping what was great out of the day. So I stack it. I think about what I want to accomplish tomorrow. I'm in the sauna. And when I come out of that damn thing, I do it at 172 degrees. So I'm done. My blood pressure drops, and it's a whole different place. And I drop off to sleep. So that gives you a feel. And obviously a change. Other things are always changing throughout the day, but those are the fundamentals.
That's amazing. Wow. You just gave a lot. And listen, I'm a biohacking nerd. So you mentioned sauna. I've got a sauna. I've got an infrared sauna at my place in St. Louis. The low all-cause mortality. Like, I've read so much on the benefits of the heat shock protein, sweating, neurogenesis.
Yeah, neurogenesis.
It's an amazing, amazing tool.
And you know what's so cool about it, Prince, is, you know, you and I are young guys. Well, I guess you're younger than I am, but still, we're young in our approach, meaning we're both physically active people. Not everybody is, even when they're 30 or 40. And this is something that you can put somebody in who wouldn't exercise and still get such a, and then I think after a while, you start feeling better. And I think they're more likely to do the other things that you and I both do. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you're a biohacker. I've got my own hyperbaric oxygen chamber right outside here. I've got cryotherapy. I mean, if you ever came to my house, your mind would be blown. I got everything you can imagine because I got a Maxima.
I've studied you. I've seen a lot of the things that you have. So, like, I know you made a video about, I think it was with Business Insider a couple of years ago. You featured the ROM machine. So I got a ROM machine at my place. I'm into it.
Well, afterwards, we'll compare notes. I'll send you a list of other goodies you may enjoy.
Let's do it. Okay. There's one small question I have just before we move. Actually, two. One is, if you're burning all of these calories on stage, how are you refeeding? Like, how are you bringing back the calories into your body?
Well, you know what's so ironic? I'm so adrenalized. I'm such, you know, and I've only in the last few years realized how important it is to go parasympathetic. You know, sympathetic is the adrenal go, go, go. And I've used that my whole life. And you got a parasympathetic to heal properly. But when you're so sympathetic, you're not really hungry. But I'm very fortunate in that two things happen. Number one, I burn, you know, my DNA shows I burn fat. And I train myself to burn fat, but I think my DNA was there as well. So it might have been unconscious to go there. But I do additional things to train my body to burn fat. Because when you burn sugar, as you know, your energy goes and then drops to the floor. I could never do what I did if I burned sugar or carbs. Mm. So when you burn fat, you can do a lot smaller volume. And it's like sugar is like lighter fluid. And, you know, fat is like coals, burns and burns for hours and hours and hours. So I'm able to do that. I feed, quite honestly, at the end of the night. I can't do it that morning very much. I do rely. I just make sure I take nothing but fats in the mornings. Okay. Right? So I'll do avocados and salad and things like that. You know, I'll do walnuts. I'll do things that will give me the fats to burn. But there's no way I can keep up the calories. But I've also, you're familiar with the biome. And I've done the biome, and the biome, you know, you have more biome than you have, you know, normal bacteria is what we're talking about in your body, more than you do actually cells. Mm-hmm. And I have this special quality that came back and showed me that only ultra athletes have, where my biome actually generates energy as well. I had a tumor, which you probably know, if you know a little bit of my past. I still have that tumor in my brain and my pituitary. And so it made me grow from 5'1" my sophomore year in high school to 6'7" now. But it also allows my body to remake its tissue pretty quickly. So a lot of guys, bodybuilders, will take, you know, injections to make that happen. My body just does it naturally. Wow. So the answer to your question is that. But then also after a few days of event that I have to start loading back up, including carbs, just to get enough sugar in my body, enough fat in my body, so I'm back up to speed. But it's not something I'd recommend. It's not the healthiest practice to go 4 to 7 to 10 days where you're on stage 13, 14 hours a day and sleeping 4 or 5 hours. But it's been a lifestyle. So it's like anything else. You can train your body to do it. And then I also use stem cells to make sure my body is healing as well. I do that about 3 times a year.
You know, we were talking about medicine, and I think, you know, diet and nutrition is so customized to the individual. It has to be, yes, right? Like, yes, we have to solve ourselves, right? Some people might be on a plant-based diet. Other people might be on a pescatarian diet, you know? Right. So I think we have to really approach diet not as a one-size-fits-all.
Are you familiar with New Amsterdam Genomics?
I'm not, no.
Okay, you should check these guys out, and your people should as well. Anybody listening? Brilliant. I just was starting. I'm writing about them right now, finishing up this book. You know, there's lots of genome tests you can get, and many of them are starting to create relationships between diet and your body and so forth. The database is pretty small, and if you talk to most scientists, they're going to go, I don't know about this. But any informed scientist that studies this group is blown away. And the reason is they'll do your genome. They'll show you what the concerns are. They show you how to balance those concerns when they're significant. You know, you have two pairs versus one pair of something that's been proven to have an impact. But then they give you dietary descriptions, lifestyle descriptions, and even drugs. Like, let's say a warfarin that some people take. Some people will die on that shit. Some people respond. And the difference they can tell now by the genome setup. That's what personalized medicine is moving towards. But here's what's really unique about them. There are 8 million articles on average every 2 weeks coming out around the world about the human genome and how it affects things. Because it's not just the genome, as you know, it's the epigenome. Your genes don't determine your destiny. That's like the light bulb. The switch is the epigenome, what you eat, what you consume, what you do. But you got to know what can be triggered by what.
Yep.
And what's amazing is this company has an AI that analyzes every 2 weeks, reads every article in the world, and then gives an update, anything that relates to your issues to you. I mean, wow. To your doctor, at least. I mean, you know, the problem for doctors are such good people. They work their ass off. They give their heart and soul. I mean, obviously, there's some doctors aren't great, just like some any industry, but 99.9% of them are amazing. But the half-life of a medical education is, I don't know, I haven't seen the most recent statistic. The old one was 4 years. I mean, in 4 years, half what they learn is out of date. So they're trying to keep up. But imagine if you're somebody's in the water in front of you and you jump in to save them because you really care, and you get out, and as soon as you get out, 2 more are drowning, and you get out, 4 more. Well, you're so busy saving people, you don't go upstream to see what's going on, and you don't have time to. So this AI reads every single article and then brings it directly to the doctor's feedback for you personally. I mean, it is an amazing breakthrough of personalized medicine. It's just literally coming out at this stage. They just got the AI where it starts to do this.
What's the name of that?
It's called New Amsterdam Genomics.
New Amsterdam. I'm going to check that out. That's amazing.
Check it out, brother.
Incredible. Well, that kind of, you know, when we talk about the technology and advancements in information, right? We live in this information age. So I always think about how education fits into the information age, right? Like, one of my biggest videos, it got 250 million views. It's a critique on the school system. We grew up with this idea that knowledge is power, but is it anymore? If you've got a cell phone, do you have to memorize information, or can we just use technology, use AI to support human beings, and we evolve into more creative endeavors, more empathetic endeavors? My question, I guess, is how do you feel about the current structure, the system of education, and where do you feel like it should go?
I think it's a disaster, personally. It's easy to be a critic of anything, right? But it's not hard to be a critic here. All you have to do is open your eyes. We've been hypnotized by the past, right? That's what happens to human beings. In the past, a college education was the pathway to a greater quality of life, and borrowing money there was a good investment because you were getting knowledge that could be applied in the marketplace and provide for you in a job, an opportunity, and hopefully things beyond that, a level of socialization, a way of connecting, a way of growing up to some extent for a stage of life for kids. It's not bad anymore. First of all, there's 111 universities in the United States alone that have $1 billion in their endowments or more. Some of them have 5 and 6 billion. They are not schools anymore. They're hedge funds attached to a university. And the way you know that is, for the last 30 years, the rate that they've been charging has been twice that of inflation. Right now, the average college educated student has $30,000 of student debt, and they're praying that our current president will get rid of it. But how is that fair? One guy goes to a local college and works his ass off to pay for it. Somebody else gets a, you know, goes to Harvard because their family can afford it. They're going to get the money back. Mm. And I just, I don't know. It doesn't feel right to me. And then what are you going to do for the next generation? Right. But the worst part is there's no mindset about the value, right? There's $1.6 trillion worth of student debt right now. Nobody's talking about it affecting this generation. But the problem is they don't have specialized knowledge that works in the marketplace. They can't even get a freaking job from it. I'll tell you the statistics. I just read it the other day. 73% of the people with a four-year college education do not work in the profession that they studied or the work that they studied. The 27% that do, 52% say they hate it.
Wow.
They don't love their work at all. They hate it. They dislike it intensely or hate it with the two choices, right? So we're in a system that is completely broken. But here's the good news. We're living in a time where self-education is available to anybody. I mean, I didn't go to college. I couldn't afford it. I wanted to go to USC. I thought I'd get a scholarship, but then my family broke up. My dad went back east. My mom was a powerful one. She kicked him out. She kicked me out. Christmas Eve, I'm 17, got to figure out what the hell to do. I had to learn to support myself. Mm-hmm. But the good news was I met Jim Rohn, my original teacher, and he taught me about self-education. And he taught me, you know, he used to say, work harder on yourself than you do your job. Constantly become a more valuable human being, and you won't have to worry. Because I remember I said to him, I had four different fathers. We were always broke. And the reason I feed, you know, I feed 100 million people a year in the United States, 100 million meals a year. I committed to 1 billion meals 6 years ago. We're already at 700 million, but I already fed 42 million over my whole life. It was just this latest push. I wanted to go to a different level. And it all came about because, you know, we had no money. We had no food. I mean, somebody fed me when I was 17. And I said, I'm going to find a way to do this for others. And I did. But the reality is my fathers were good men. So I remember asking him, why is it? All four of my fathers were good men. Why we couldn't have a meal on Thanksgiving? You know, my life was changed because somebody brought food to us on Thanksgiving. It's like made me realize strangers care, made me care more about strangers. But I said, what is it? And Jim told me, he said, Tony, we're all equal as souls. We're not equal in the marketplace. I thought that was really interesting. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, your soul is absolute in its value. So is everyone's. I know you believe that, Tony. He said, but in the marketplace, we have to grow and add value. The only way to get wealthy is do more for others than anybody else is doing and do it consistently. You'll build a brand and continue to do it and you'll have independence. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's more than just money, Tony. It's a sense of meaning in your life. He goes, if you see somebody working at McDonald's, I'm not knocking them. Yeah. But let's think of how much added value is that job behind the cash register. And today it's even less because they have pictures. You don't even have to speak the language. What one number do you want, right? But it's like, you can learn that job, he explained to me back then, like 15, 20 minutes. Let's call it 4 hours, call it half a day or a day. Within a week, you certainly, if you have no intelligence, can do that job. Mm. How much added value there? Right. That's why they get minimum wage. Because I was saying it, but these teachers do so much more valuable things. They don't earn enough. And this billionaire guy, remember I gave him the examples of this hedge fund guy. He made $3 billion or $2 billion back then. And he goes, Tony, he brought a 40% return when those days 5% was a big deal, right? He said, you know, that means these people are going to double their money in 2 years. These are institutions, organizations, people. These are people's 401ks. Mm. He's worth $2 billion. Mm. This person moved your fries around. And now something that a robot does most of, there's not a lot of value. So it's not about their souls. Mm. It's about you have to become more valuable. You have to learn to grow and expand. And so this lesson is not taught in the university. What's taught now is equity. We all should be equal outcomes, not equal opportunity, which is what the Constitution is about, equal outcomes, right? Which then makes kids mad when they don't have what they have. Instead of saying, what do I need to do to grow and add more value? Society is calling me to give something. Mm. It's like society owes me something. And that's where we're getting so much challenge in our country today. And it starts mostly in the way they're being taught in the universities that are charging a fortune and putting these poor kids in massive debt. So the solution, let's talk about the problem one more step deeper just for a second. The bigger problem is not the debt. Mm. The bigger problem is not the crappy education that easy for me to say, but when I say crappy, not usable in the marketplace, okay? There's parts of the education I think are rich and beautiful. The artistic side of it, I don't deny that at all. Mm. But for the dollars spent for the debt for a decade or more, it certainly is not proportional to its value, at least on the surface to me personally. But here's the bigger issue. And I've talked to four living presidents about this. I haven't got one person that really got it. And it blew my mind. Think about this. Up a century and a half ago, 150 years ago, 84%, 85% of America was a farmer. Think about that. Okay. Now it's less than 3% and we feed the whole world. Technology, as you pointed out, right? But the change happened over about 100 years. Right now, we have technologies that are coming that if you read the studies at Oxford or anyplace else, they're talking about 42% of all jobs being disrupted. There's a study that shows in 2040, we're going to lose 1 billion jobs. But the mindset, and I get this mindset, part of my mindset too, is, oh, we'll get rid of those and we'll get some new jobs. Mm-hmm. Right? That's always what's happened. The difference is timing, Prince. A big difference in timing. Because right now, let's just take one technology, self-driving cars. There's zero question it's going to happen. Is it going to happen 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, or 10 years? There's zero question it'll be the standard within 10 years. I mean, anybody intelligent knows, okay? So what happens to 5 million truck drivers, Uber drivers, and taxi drivers? That's the number of jobs we lost in 2008 that put the economy through the floor. And no one is going to them. Like, I was sitting down with President Obama, and he's really bright and beautiful man with a giant heart. And I was like, Mr. President, I said, you know, I know you must care about these issues. I mean, this is coming. You know, like, what's going to happen? He goes, well, Tony, you know, nobody really knows. But, you know, we think, I said, now's the time to start saying your job will be gone in 5 or 7 years. So let's retrain you into something that gives you the same or greater income, right? Some other new added value, not just hope they'll find their way. He goes, you know, we think those new jobs will show up. And I was just like, I want to shake him, you know, with all due respect. That hope is not a strategy for humanity. Hope is not a strategy for people's economics, right? And so I could take 4 jobs and show you I could eliminate 15 or 20 million jobs, professions that we know are coming, but we're doing nothing about. And meanwhile, we're charging more and more for the university level. And some of these universities charge during COVID, even though the kids weren't able to go the whole time. So I think it's a disaster. So I think the solution is what you see millions and millions of people doing all around the world, self-education. You know, if you have a cell phone and you live in Kenya, you can get an education from MIT, from Harvard, as you know, from anywhere in the world. You can also self-educate. You can go to people that don't talk a good game, but have actually built the business or 5 or 10 or 20, or in my case, I've got 80 now plus, right? It's like, okay, this person's probably not lucky. If they got 80 successful companies in these 12 different industries, they must know something I don't know. And if I know it, I could do the same thing as opposed to I'm going to tell someone who drones on and on to me about something and they've never even done what they're talking about. So I think that self-education is the gift. And because of the web and because of technology today, you and I can be in a different location, but be in each other's presence and learn from each other. So to me, I see the clear solution. But for a large number of people, they're going to get with a Mack truck and it's going to hit our society because with that many people are unhappy, the solution you hear people talk about is UBI, right? Universal basic income. You know anything about human character, and I know you do, Prince, there's a problem. No matter how much you give them, it'll never be enough because there's something more than money involved. There's a sense of your own sense of identity, your sense of meaning that comes from doing something beyond yourself, doing something to serve beyond yourself. Has an intrinsic psychological and spiritual value that goes beyond money. And no matter how much money it is, it'll never be enough. So I'm sure we'll probably end up in that direction because the government has wiped out so many people's jobs and opportunities and made people depend upon the government. Now they start going, well, maybe the government is my source. And we're seeing a shift in our society based on it. But I think individuals have the power to educate themselves. You want to be a lifelong learner. You want to constantly learn. I am a reflection of that and that alone. It took me from total poverty to working with every living president, 3 past presidents, 3 or 4 different communities of princes and queens around the world, some of the top athletes, business people on earth, all because I've continually updated my education.
So I got my degree. A lot of people don't know, but it was in biological anthropology.
Wow.
I'm fascinated with the human species. And what I see is a kind of a truism within the human species is it is very difficult for us to think about large scale and long term problems.
Exactly right.
Right. So you just said hope is not a strategy. And I think if we want to survive as a species, even as an individual, we have to start looking to the future and prepare for the future. Yeah. Right. Which brings us directly to this challenge that we're doing. Right. Own your future challenges. It's a lot of amazing people that are going to be involved in this challenge. You got Dean Graziosi, I think Brendan Burchard, Jenna Kutcher, a lot of amazing people. I want you to say a few words about this challenge, why it's important, and who should be joining in the challenge.
you know, Dean started doing them a few years ago, and then they started being modeled by everybody. And then Dean came to me and said, we ought to do this. Cause I said, I want to do something. This is last July for everybody who's stuck at home. Mm-hmm. And so we said, well, let's do this challenge. So we ended up supposed to do 2 days and 3 days. And I think I promised 5 days and delivered seven, right? So, but we had, you know, 386,000 people for the first one. And then in January, I thought, okay, we're still not back to work. I'll do one more. It's new year, new life. And we did that. We had 865,000 people from 195 countries. Every country recognized by the UN, the world participated. So, and I built some new technology that allows us to do this at a different level. Mm-hmm. So this challenge I'm doing because I'm privileged enough to have an unbelievable gift. I've been in an industry that now is growing in the middle of COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, I made it grow for me, but it's been growing as a whole over COVID because it's the self-education industry. And it's Forbes says this industry is going to grow to $1 billion a day by 2025, less than 4 years from now. It's about a half billion right now. And so I see this industry that I get so much fulfillment from. It's like way beyond money. You give me money, I got a ton of companies. I got more money I could spend, but why do I get 75, 80% of my time here? Because to make a difference in someone's life, to have an idea, perception, strategy, or tool to do that is so fulfilling. And so I teach business mastery, and I can show somebody how to grow their business 30 to 130% a year. I do it like clockwork. $1 billion companies just starting. I know how to do that. I know the patterns. There's only so many patterns. That's why I'm able to have all these companies. We had $6 billion in sales in my companies alone. Mm. So you look at that growth and go, okay, I know how to do that. But if you don't have a vehicle, it really can't help you. And I think more people need a vehicle now because the government has managed to shut down the economy and destroy so many companies and jobs. This challenge is really, it's not just me. It's this army of just brilliant people. They're all in the self-education business. And it isn't about just inspiring you. It's about each day making some distinctions and then learning how to use technology to do things that when I started, you know, I've been around a while, right? It's my I'm entering my 44th year of doing this, believe it or not. I started when I was three, of course. 44 years, I can tell you, like 20 years ago, like it cost a fortune to go send your brochures and rent the room and all that shit. And now with technology, you can do in minutes what used to take me months to get done. Mm. And so we have all these technologies we developed, and we're just going to share them with you so that by the end of this, you know, challenge, these few days, few hours a day, you'll either have a business if you don't have one if you want, or you'll have a business you already have that will be able to grow. So I'm excited about it. Yeah, I'm helping to anchor it. I've helped set it up. But I don't think I've got only the answers. That's why I want people to meet various people, men, women, people from every different aspect of how to attack this so that you say, hey, if I don't have my own economy, if I'm dependent on someone else's plan for my life, I'm going to fit into their plan. I don't have a very compelling future. Maybe it's time for me to say, in the middle of all this craziness, maybe I can do something short term on the side here that gives me a new opening that could grow to that. Or I just go for it, or I take something I got to the next level. And that's what it's about. And there's no charge for it. There's no charge. And then here's a fee. There's just no charge for it. We're adding enough value to people that hopefully their lives will change. And then you may want to do more with us and, you know, become a client, which is just a great model also for education as well.
I'm definitely going to get the word out to everybody. I know, you know, I've got this quote in the back, freedom is the only worthy goal in life. Epictetus, you know, Stoic Absolutely. Philosopher. And that's I think awesome. It's true. I think that's what the challenge is for, is to really become free.
You're right.
So that you can shine. You can convey the gift that's already inside of you to the world and get rid of the clouds that are blocking the sun.
Yeah. I agree with you, brother. Freedom.
Freedom. I know we're a little bit on time over time, but I got two questions that I think the audience would love. So this month is Mental Health Awareness Month. Depression is a huge, huge issue. I think it's the second leading cause of death in teenagers. It might be the first because it's so underreported. It's a lot of young people that are watching this right now. I guess what strategies, what tools can you share right now to somebody who might be going through a tough time, a mood depression or something like that? Is there anything you can share with us?
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't know if you saw the stats. I don't know how accurate they are, but the CDC has reported that one out of four 20 to 30 year olds in the last year has considered suicide. So I don't know how accurate it is, but I know, you know, there's been more overdoses in San Francisco, drug overdoses in the last year than there are COVID deaths by far. So there's a dynamic when you're missing what's called a compelling future. You can deal with any horrible today if you've got a compelling tomorrow. But I think what's happened for a lot of young people is they listen to the news. And unfortunately, the news is not designed to inspire you, educate you, or uplift you. It has one job, get your attention. We're no longer, people talk about, you know, information society. That's bullshit. The information society died a long time ago. There's too much information. You're drowning in information. We're starving for some wisdom, right? So the news, they're not bad people. They're good people, but their job is to make a profit. And they know that there's something about the human psyche that's their survival instinct, that when something scares us, when something is horrible, our brain goes there. And so that's why if it bleeds, it leads. And if they can't find something to bleed, they'll make something to bleed, right? They'll just create the frame. So if you watch the news, you think the earth is over. We're living in a place where it's easy to get depressed if you do not take control of what input you're getting. Mm. My original teacher, Jim Rohn, I remember he said to me one day, he said, Tony, goes, I got a question for you. He said, what happens, you know, if your worst enemy drops sugar in your coffee? I said, you got sweet coffee. He goes, what if your best friend, your lover, your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, family member, somebody you really adore, by accident drops one drop of strychnine in your coffee? What happened? I go, you'd be dead. Mm. That's right. So remember, life is both sugar and strychnine, and watch your coffee. Mm. Meaning, he used to say, every day, stand guard at the door of your mind. Because otherwise, your mind is going to be controlled by everybody else. You got to think independently, but it's impossible when you're being primed all the time for life is horrible. It's ending. Like you talk to kids, they think the whole world, they'll listen to that little Guther, what's her name, the girl that they put on the cover of Time. The world is on fire. The house, the place is burning down. You know, AOC's telling people that the world's going to end in 12 years if we don't make drastic changes. And the changes we're making, if you agree to all of them, wouldn't make that drastic a change. But keep beliefs create and beliefs destroy.
Yep. Wow.
And you got to be so careful what you come to believe. And most people's belief are just what they've been told over and over again with so much emotion and intensity. And then they see examples of it. It's like if I said to your audience right now, look around the room right now for everything you can find that's brown. Go ahead and try it. If you're in the room, look around, see everything that's brown. And then close your eyes. Then tell me everything in the room that's red. Now, if you're seeing more brown than red, there's a reason. You were looking for brown. You go, but there is more brown. That's true, but do this now. Look for red. Look for red in your room. Look for red. Look for anywhere you can find red. Look for red. There's red books behind you there. There's red over here. I can see it in your room. Lots of red. Okay? Did you find more red this time? Yeah. Why? Because you looked for it. Now, I'll prove it to you. You get what you look for even when it's not there. Mm. How many of you saw beige shit, called it brown just to feel successful? How many saw burgundy, called it red, just so you could count more elements, right? All right? So once you believe shit, you're going to find references to back it up. And if it's not really accurate, you'll still spin it. I'm not talking about them, what others may do to you for their own profit. I'm talking about what we do to ourselves out of the need for consistency. So the answer to your question is, you got to start feeding your mind every day consciously and blocking it out. I mean, Rohn used to have this phrase, and when he first said it, I thought he was an asshole, I'll be honest with you. But then I got a deeper meaning. He said, you know what? Make life a study. Mm. He said, if you want to be healthy, study health. If you want to be happy, study happiness. He said, find out what poor people read. This is what annoyed me. Find out what poor people read and don't read it. He said, because what you're reading is putting the fabric of your mind that you're making emotions and decisions from and actions from. Yeah. And he wasn't, you know, you dig in with him, he wasn't shallow. He used to say, no, what I mean by poor is they poor mentally, emotionally, poor habits. It's like rich is joy, happiness, great family, great relationships, sense of meaning, impact, finances, all of it, right? Healthy body. So the answer to your question is, I've never lost a suicide in all these years of what I'm working with. I've done with thousands. We've made films of them, followed up with people. Yeah. Now, somebody could have committed suicide later on and me not know it, but certainly not in a suicidal moment ever, right? Mm. But what's really interesting is when people kill themselves, there is a reason. That's why I'm able to help people. They have to have a belief. They have to believe that dying is less painful than living. Yeah. If all you do is shift that and get them to believe that maybe dying could be more painful than living, they won't do it. If that's all you did, much less if you create a compelling future. So think of it this way for your audience. Stop letting yourself listen to all the shit that's being shoved your way for economic benefit of someone else. If you haven't already seen this, you know, the social, what's it called?
Dilemma.
Dilemma. Go watch it. There are literally people who are wiring the dopamine in your brain to make you angry and to make you excited and to make you continue to do what you're doing. And they're making more money than God. Mm. $1 trillion valuations on these companies, right? It's not being derogatory. It's not being leftist. It's not being thinking, you know, conspiracy. It's a fact. But you have the power to change it. Like whenever you're getting something for free from, you know, somebody like Google or somebody like ongoing free forever, You can't be getting something free forever. You are the product. And they're using your brain to get you to gently do the things they want you to do. And it's not exciting. Social media, there's all kinds of studies. The more times people spend on social media, the more likely to be depressed, because they don't actually need other humans. They need the projections other humans do to try and look good. Mm. I have a friend that owns a gym, and he said, Tony, I couldn't believe when he showed me this. Show me pictures of this. He's like, this happens 2 or 3 times a week. A woman or a man will come in, lay out everything, take a zillion pictures, and leave. They don't do the workout. It's just to project, like, what a great person they are. I mean, it's the, and they go through all the trouble of, might as well have worked out in between, right? But they don't, right? That's the world we now live in. So you compare to bullshit, and you're going to be depressed. If you think there's no future because the world's on fire and it's burning down, we're all going to die in 12 years and COVID's going to kill everybody, then of course you're going to be, and somebody took your job and you got a lot of debt. I get it. But your soul is bigger than anything you've ever faced. And every generation that has faced something horrific and not given up, that's the generation we call the great generations. And I think this generation of millennials and Zs, or however they want to be called now, that generation has the opportunity to be one of the great generations in history. They're the, one of the largest. They're going to be bigger than the baby boomers now, size-wise. And they have all this technology. But the question is, technology, you can kill people with electricity or you can light up a city.
Yeah.
Unless you're conscious in the use, you're going to be depressed by the very technology because you're letting other people run your brain. Take back control. How? Let me give you 3 things and I'll shut the hell up. 1, physiology first. The way you think, the way to breathe, the emotions you feel. Like, think about, what is the quality of your life? How much money you have? You have a lot of money and be depressed and kill yourself. People do it all the time. You can have no money and be euphoric. People do it all the time.
Yep.
So it's not money. Money doesn't make you mean or make you good. Money just magnifies you. If you're mean, you got more to be mean with. If you're giving, you'll give more. It's that simple, right? So it has nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. So you got to think about, what is controlling the quality of your life? And the answer is your emotions. The meanings you give things. If I'm being abused, you're going to have one feeling. This person is challenging me, that's a different feeling. This person is coaching me, that's a different feeling. This person is loving me, that's a different feeling. This is happening because God is punishing me. This is happening because God has abandoned me. This is happening because God is challenging me. This problem is here as a gift from God. One change in meaning will instantly change your emotion from angry or sad or depressed or worthless to empowered or strengthened or driven or hungry or giving or growing. One meaning change, one emotion change. But here's the problem. You have habitual emotions. I call it the emotional home. People that are angry. You ever notice people are angry? Always find something angry about. People that are funny find humor in every shit. People that worried worry about, if they don't think worry about in their own life, they worry about things they don't need, people they don't even know, right? We have emotional homes, and some of us need to upgrade our home. Because if you see in the news, and let's say you see, I don't know if any of your listeners or viewers have, you know, seen some place where there's a storm that comes about every 2 or 3 years and it wipes out everything and the family cries, they're all gone. I don't know if any of you think this, but I think sometimes, why don't they move? Right? Why do they keep going back to that? And of course, I know the answer. It's because it's home. We go back to what we know, even if what we know is not great. And the emotional home, it's easy to see when it's someone's location. What some of us don't realize is we have an emotional home. It doesn't matter who you're in relationship with, you're going to keep feeling these feelings until you change you.
Yep.
It doesn't matter what happens in the economy, until you change you, you're still going to have these feelings, whether they're good or bad. Yeah. And most people, they're not good because the human brain is 2 million years old. And it's mostly survival. It's always looking for what could go wrong, what could hurt me, what could destroy me. And so I got to fight it or I got to flight, whichever one you've developed the pattern of, or I'm going to freeze and hope it goes by. But there is no saber-tooth tiger going to kill you now, but we worry about what do people think about us or how much money do we have. And listen, I mean, those are worthy things I'm sure at some level think about, but they're not life and death. But we've made them life and death. And that's why people get so depressed. So what do you need? When I work with somebody who's depressed, the first thing I do is change their physiology, because a depressed person has a certain way of using their body. If I said, there's a depressed person over here behind this picture, you can't see them, but I'll give a $100,000 donation, Prince, to your favorite charity if you can describe their physiology. Tell me what their body's like if they're depressed.
Slumped over.
That's right, slumped over, shoulders down, heads down. Yep. Breathing full or shallow, what would you say?
Shallow.
Talking loud or quiet?
Very quiet.
Fast or slow?
Slow.
That's right. And their whole body is like all that's out of it. Now, if you take that same person, you put their shoulders back, you make them breathe, you get them to talk more, you get them moving more rapidly, you literally change their biochemistry like that. And so there's habits. We use our body in a certain way. Our face, we have 37 different, I think it's 32 different muscles in the face. 32 different muscles. Most people, this is the largest area of unemployment in the country, right? They do the same expressions, so they feel the same emotions. So the first thing I do is I'll get somebody to work out. I'll get them to start training. Because think about it, fear and sadness, they're physical. They're not just mental. If you got fear and it's real fear, you have a hard time swallowing or you feel it in your gut, right? But courage is also physical, right? Courage is not that you're not afraid. It's that you're afraid, but you do it anyway. It's a different sensation. It's a push through. So when I get up in the morning and I go for a sprint or I go lift or I jump in the cold water, anything I do that makes me push beyond, it pushes that blood through and you feel that strength again. And all of a sudden, it's a different world. Mm. So I always say physiology first. Second, you need a compelling future. Mm. You need to stop the bullshit of believing all, because people always think the brain's afraid, the old brain, like it's natural for the old brain to run you, but you have consciousness and you can wake up and go, that's the old brain doing what it does. But let me create, I'm a creator. I'm not here to maintain and survive. I'm here to create life on my terms. God's given me the ability to create. What am I going to create? Mm. And then you start to figure out what do you want and you start to build it. So you need to train your body to be strong because it'll train your emotions to be strong. You got to make sure your nutrition is strong because your blood chemistry is going to change whether you're depressed or not. And then thirdly, you got to create a compelling future. Mm. Those three things are the minimum that I would say for people to be able to do to turn it around. But again, I'm telling you verbally, we do it with people over and over again. And then you see them change in seconds. You go, wow, this is, and then they feel it. And then you develop the new habits and all of a sudden depression is bullshit. I was massively depressed to the point where, you know, you have those thoughts like, should I be here or not at one stage? And something in me clicked and said, this is not going the right direction. I can't go in this direction anymore. And I used anger in the beginning because anger was better than depression for me because anger would get me to do something.
Yeah.
Depression made me just accept it all. Yep. And then gradually I got beyond anger into creation. You know, into contribution, into appreciation. And by the way, you can't suffer and appreciate simultaneously. I always tell people, trade your expectations for appreciation and your life changes in that moment. Because the minute you appreciate anything, you can't suffer anymore. You get outside yourself.
Holistic, like I said, I love it. It's all together, you know, movement, you know, behavioral activation, diet. I love that. And the future. That's beautiful.
And I got to put one more with you. Language. Yeah. This phrase called watch your TV, watch your transformational vocabulary, because the words you attach to your experience become your experience. So when I used to get really upset, oh, this is so depressing, I'd say it all the time. The minute you say it, your biochemistry becomes it. So I've got a friend, Ken Blanchard. He wrote those books, the 1 Minute Manager books that people read years ago. He's now, I think he's almost 80 years old. Brilliant, beautiful man. One time I was invited to go on a trip with a group of my friends that are all in the movie business, big players, right? And they're going to Africa and they're going to Ngorongoro Crater, which some of the greatest, you know, creatures on earth are still there. It's where man supposedly began. And I can't go because I got events. They said, well, is there somebody you recommend? I said, yeah, I'd tell you somebody who's just a good human being. You love having him and he's different than the rest of you. Ken. So he goes on the trip. And here's the 2 second story. There's a guy on the trip, I won't mention who's, you know, amongst the Hollywood elite. He's one of the biggest, one of the most powerful. And a little bit at that time, drunk with power and ego. And so he pushes the drivers, you know, in these trucks to take the roofs off. And the guy runs it, says, listen, we're going down in the crater. And you don't understand. If there's something breaks down and we get stuck in that crater, there's no way out. And these animals will jump in and eat you. And he goes, oh, you're such a wuss. And he just pushes these guys so much that they finally, he's so relentless, they take the roofs off. They go down in the crater in the afternoon. It's time. He keeps going. Let's go further. Let's go further. He nags them. They do it. You can see where this is going. All of a sudden, explosive sound. The axle falls out. They're all alone in the middle of Ngorongoro Crater, and they should have already headed home. And the sun's starting to come down. And who's the first person to scream and cry and yell because he's afraid he's going to die is the same guy. And everybody's freaking out. And several people told me the story. So I got to hear from several people I know on the trip. And it was just an S show, you know, just insane. Everybody's pissed and angry and scared. And people think they're going to die. And in the middle of it, three people told me, Ken Blanchard said, this is inconvenient.
Great.
And he wasn't joking. It's just like, for him, the worst a day out there could be is a great day. So it's a little inconvenience. We'll find a way, right? And that's his belief. That's the language he uses for everything. I've never seen Ken really pissed off. The most something is inconvenient, we'll figure it out, right? And it was so different than everybody else that several people started to laugh. He broke the pattern. They finally got into the truck. They got him out of there. Everybody was okay. But it's just a metaphor. If you use certain words all the time, this pisses me off. Well, you're always going to be pissed off. Or I'm really worried about this. You're always worried. Yeah. Change your habitual language. Believe it or not, like when I stopped calling myself depressed, I've never used that to describe myself in 37, 38, probably 44 years, I guess now. It's been a lot of years. Wow. But I used to use it a lot. I felt it a lot. And I remember I put a poster. I was sleeping in this laundry room of a friend's because I was on my own. And I put this poster up and it said, only a loser is depressed, which is not true. But I knew I wasn't a loser. So that was my leverage. Mm. And then, you know, I crossed out depression and then I stopped using it. I'd say, okay, I feel a little saddened by this a little bit. Or I feel a little frustrated. Or I feel a little whatever, but I wouldn't use it. Yeah. And it changed your life. So get a compelling future, change your language, change your inputs, and change your body. Those would be the things to do real quick.
Language is so important. You know, during my anthropological studies, we learned about linguistic relativity. And essentially the theory is your language determines your reality.
That's right.
The words you use determines what you experience. I mean, they've done so many studies on different cultures. They can't see certain colors because they don't have a word for it.
Exactly right.
If you go in somewhere and you think it's a junkyard. Right. You see everything as a piece of scrap metal. And then somebody runs in and says, hey, this isn't a junkyard. It's actually an art gallery. And then immediately everything goes from a piece of scrap metal to a work of art. By the way, language is so, so important. Thank you for sharing that. That's a big one that a lot of people, they skip over. But that's so, so huge. Well,
I really think, brother, that's one of your great gifts. I didn't know you'd studied it, but it's one of your great gifts. It's one of the reasons I think people are touched by you is that you, like you said, it comes from the heart. So it's felt by the heart. I love your principle. I believe that's totally true. I believe the same thing, but you also from the heart find words that you think will penetrate or touch or move people. And you do an amazing job. And I want to sincerely compliment you.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. I'm trying, my thing is to find that master key. You know, what is that master key that unlocks everybody's heart that comes into contact with it? This is kind of my ambitionless ambition, you know, because I don't crave it, but it's something that I'm really, you know, I'm desiring to do.
I love that. I'd offer you a consideration of another metaphor, because metaphors also like language shape us. For decades, people were taught that the nucleus, you know, that the center of the cell, the nucleus, that if you looked outside of it, you have these electrons that were going around like in the solar system, like a planet. But that put a belief in people's heads that was completely false for two decades and kept progress from happening. Mm-hmm. And that was, if you use that metaphor, then you think it stays equidistant as it goes around the nucleus, and that's not how it works. And we missed so many breakthroughs because the metaphor they use. There's nothing wrong with your metaphor. It's gorgeous. But I consider another one you might want to add to it if you think it makes any sense. Maybe you need a key chain, because there are different keys for different parts. And if we look for just the one, I love that. But that's kind of when people oversimplify and they go, for example, I'm sure you remember when they came out with The Secret, and I refused to participate, not because I didn't believe that the law of attraction is real. Of course it is. But it's one of many laws. Mm. And we start thinking that's the only one. I remember saying to a friend of mine, he was a guy who cut my hair. He goes, I did this thing, today. And I read this book. And he goes, I've been thinking green light. I hit all green lights. And I said to him, okay, there's about 30 of them between where you are and seeing me. What's going to happen next time when you get more red lights, even though you've been thinking green? Are you going to be a failure then? Did you not follow the law of attraction? Are you telling me that somebody who went in a concentration camp did there because of their negative thoughts? Sometimes not getting what you want is life's way of making sure you grow and develop skills that will then give you gifts for yourself and those you're here to serve in the future. So this oversimplification, sometimes it feels good. Mm. And it takes us down a path where we miss something richer. And I know you're not going to miss squat, so I have zero criticism of it, but I'm always listening for metaphors, just like language. And I see the benefit. The benefit here is I'm going to find that answer. I love that about you. And I know it's true. But you might discover there's lots of different answers for different parts of people. And if you have that, which I think you already do, by the way, brother, you might feel that metaphor being fulfilled more rapidly and maybe more accurately.
I think you're right. I think diversity is nature's language, right? Like diversity is how it's the reason why we're here. Everything is so different. So there's so many different ways up the mountain.
True. Or through it or under it. or taking it in while you stand on top of it instead of just burrowing through it. Right? There's so many choices, but we all develop a model of the world that makes us only see part of the world.
Yes.
And it's like, me too. I have that same experience, but it's like, I think the beauty of life is hopefully we get experience more and more of it and appreciate more and more of it. And I know you bring that to people. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do this with you, because I know where your heart is. And I also know your execution. You've done a beautiful job.
Thank you, brother. That's a great segue into the last question, which is relationship.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure you get a lot of questions around relationship. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we're here. It is the reason why we're here. You know, I mean, we are a gregarious species. We love being, you know, people, and we have to be around. We all support each other. We all breathe the same air. And in romantic relationships, it's so easy for people to grow apart. You know, my parents, they got divorced after 30 years recently in the news. You know, you got Bill and Melinda, that divorce. I don't know the circumstances, but I know divorce is on the rise. And through your studies, through your experience, for me, I feel like nobody wants to get divorced, especially when they go into it. But what would your advice be to keep a healthy relationship, you know, a loving, inspiring, energetic relationship?
Well, this is an area that we could go really deep, and I've given you long answers. I apologize. So let me try and do a tight version of this, because this is so important, because I believe the quality of your life is the quality of your relationships, period. And the one that infects you the most is family, but the deepest one is your intimate relationship. Because the deepest fear that every human has, and I don't care if it's President of the United States or a top athlete, you know, or musical artist that seems to have it all, I get to work with them all. What I've seen universally is that we all have a fear at some level that we're not enough. Not in every moment. We're not old enough or young enough or smart enough or sexy enough or entertaining enough or something enough. And that doesn't matter as much, but when it's someone whose love you crave, then it matters. Because the deeper fear is, if I'm not enough, I won't be loved. And love is the oxygen of the soul. A baby that isn't physically, kinesthetically loved develops failure to thrive syndrome and dies. That's how important love is to the human species. So in the beginning, we're all loved unconditionally because our moms are on drugs. I don't mean artificial ones. I mean oxytocin. Dads get it too, but moms get about tenfold of it. So that child, they think it's most beautiful. If you ever met a mother who didn't think her child was the most beautiful thing in the world, even though they're toothless, they're spitting up, they're hairless? Try that shit when you're 40. See if people love you. Right? It's a different thing, right? Crap all over you and they still love you, right? But eventually that oxytocin wears off. And suddenly you do the same behavior. You scream, yell, you go to the bathroom in your pants. And now you get yelled at or you get smacked or the worst one, you get ignored. So that produces fear in people. And so we're wanting that same unconditional love forever. And I've always asked, like, why is it as a species that we're given all this unconditional love up front? You know, it's biochemically, if your mother is biochemically healthy, you're going to get it. And if she doesn't do it, if you survive, somebody else will go over. Grandma, grandpa, a dad, a brother, sister, somebody. You wouldn't have survived because someone had to put your needs ahead of their own.
Right.
That takes love. That takes something more than just about me, me, me. And so I really think it's because if we would have stayed that way, you'd never grow. You just demand everything, expect it, and you wouldn't give anything to life, right? So now we go in relationships, and what are we unconsciously looking for? Complete, unconditional love. But everybody's afraid it's really not there because our history shows it's probably not. And you have two different people that have grown up with different models of the world of what to notice, what to appreciate, what language to use, how to deal with finance, how you might raise a child if you even knew how to do it. Like, so many different models. And those models might have a lot of things in common, but there's ones when they're in conflict, and we don't show people how to value the relationship more than the conflict. It's like, you want to be right or you want to be in love, right? You know, do you want to learn or do you want to pontificate and separate yourself, right? And so, but I think there is, you know, some master keys to making a relationship work. And I think, honestly, you got to understand that what makes a relationship work and what makes a relationship passionate are two different things. What makes it work is things in common, things you value in common, things you experience in common. What makes it passionate are differences in energies, masculine and feminine energies. And so most relationships do not die for a lack of love. They die for a lack of intimacy. And intimacy isn't just sexual, but it is that energetic exchange between masculine and feminine energies. Even if you have a gay or lesbian relationship, if it's going to go where it's passionate, there has to be opposite energies. One is more masculine energy and one more feminine. Otherwise, it's like the planet. There's two poles on either side. They're opposite. That's where all the energy of the earth comes from. If they're the same, there's nothing. You put those plugs in. If there's not two, and at least in American electricity, it's not going to work. You need them both to be able to create that electricity, that energy. So I tell people the single most important thing in a relationship is selection. Selection is 95% of the success in a relationship. Oh, thank you, Tony. I've been in this relationship already. Why don't you teach me how to select in the past? No, no. Who you select to be in the relationship is more important than just who you pick. Because in the beginning, you brought out a certain part of that person. And you go, now we're together forever. Where'd that person go? Well, you changed. You're looking at them. I'm sure they changed, but you changed. We're all in a cybernetic loop. If I want to change you, Prince, I don't work on you. I work on me. If I change me, you're going to change. If I do what you can predict, you're going to deal with me the same way. But if I change, because we're in a loop, you're going to have to change just for us to stay in some form of connection, right? So my view is, who did you choose to be in the beginning of the relationship? Who are you choosing to be now? When you were on the hunt, who were you? What were you looking out for? Was your goal to get what I want? Or if you went deep, you probably got lit up by lighting that person up. Yeah. It wasn't about measuring. What did I give? What did they give? That's a transaction. Transactions end, right? They end into a relationship that maybe stays together for 30 years, but not alive, or it ends the relationship. What makes us feel alive is this feeling of love where we want to give it. We want to like somebody. I want to please somebody. And for some people in the beginning, they'll do anything. But after 7 days or 7 months or 7 years or 70 years, they get to the law of familiarity and it becomes about themselves.
Yep.
So they're no longer selecting, who do I need to bring out my beloved? They're just going, why don't I have a beloved anymore? And then they leave that person, go to the next, they run to the next. Now, don't get me wrong. Some people, selection's also important. I look at it three ways. I'll give you this real fast and I'll shut up because we could go a million places here. You have to have that polarity. Relationships don't end for a lack of love. They end from a lack of polarity. When you both get masculine or both get feminine about something because you're dealing with something stressful, whatever it is, you're not going to have polarity. And when you don't have polarity, people judge things differently. When you have polarity, when you have all this attraction, they do something you think it's cute. When the attraction's not there, when there's no polarity, it's like, what the hell are they doing? Right? And you build up resistance and maybe some resentment or some rejection. And then all of a sudden you're not as intimate. And then all of a sudden you don't trust. And then you start to say, well, that person's different than me. And you make up a story and the story destroys the whole thing. Right? But if you're trying to select in advance, there's three questions that you should answer. And I tell you these, I'll give them to you in a business context because most people, and many of your audience, especially, I know owns their own business or they're considering it. In a company, it's not who you hire that destroys the company. It's who you fail to fire, right? They're the ones mess it up. So three questions if you want to hire somebody or you want to be in a relationship. First question is, can they do the job? Can they do the job at the level you want it? If I'm interviewing someone in my company, the answer is yes, because someone's already screened them, you know, multiple people. I still go to verify. If you've been with somebody 6 months or a year, you know they can do the job. The real question is number two, will they do the job long term? See, in business, that's easier to evaluate. And the way you do that is you look at two things. What are their goals, right? That's number one. And what's their nature? So if I meet somebody and I go to hire a personal assistant, which I did years ago, I had a personal assistant been with me for 6 years, and she's part of our family. And we all love her. She loves us. And she fell in love and got married and has kids, so she couldn't travel with us. So we went to the LA Association of Personal Assistants. I went through probably 7 assistants in probably 9 months. I'm like, what's wrong with this picture? You know? And the answer was simple. Where I was fishing, most of these people did not have a goal to serve a family. Their goal was to move to LA, work part-time as a personal assistant so that they could write their movie, be the actor. And they all loved all my celebrity clients. They took incredible care of my celebrity clients. What made me fire them is they didn't take care of people that weren't famous. Right? And so the bottom line is there's nothing wrong with the people. It's just their goals don't match the job. You follow? And then the other part you got to really look at is like, okay, if you have an accountant who's very social, can they do the job? Yes. Will they do the job long-term? The answer is no, not a traditional accountant. Right? Can you have a salesperson that's introverted? Can they succeed? Yes, they could. Will they long-term? No way in hell. Their nature doesn't match the job in a relationship. If you're outgoing and they're quiet and that supports each other, that's different. But if you're competing for it, you're going to have a challenge. And then the last question, you got, can they do the job? Will they do the job long term? What's the team fit? And that, I'm talking in shorthand, there are 6 human needs everybody has. And whatever your top two needs drives your life. So some people are driven by significance more than love. Mm. Some people are driven more by certainty more than love. Mm. Some people want to grow more than anything else. If your top two needs are their bottom two and vice versa, you can make this relationship work, but it's going to be work forever because people's need structures make them behave in different ways. So if you can answer those three questions, you can know whether it's likely to be the right person. And then you got to say, who do I need to be to keep bringing out the best in me?
Wow. That's it. That's, you know, I mean, you gave a crash course in well, life mastery, right? I wish we were all born with an instruction manual, but luckily we have you to learn from.
And you and all the rest of us out there, just seekers trying to find answers, and we find them hopefully sharing with people that, you know, want to learn more and want to have a better quality of life. And that's part of the gift of life is like, if it all was already built in, you wouldn't experience the joy of growth and discovery, right? And
that's
what we get to
keep learning. That's it. That's it. Well, I'm freaking amazed and inspired and have been educated in ways that I haven't been in a long time. That I'm sure my audience is as well. So I want to thank you for taking all of this time to have these amazing conversations. We got a lot of gold in here. So thank you so much, Tony.
Well, thank you, Prince. And please continue your beautiful work. I know you're touching a lot of lives. I'm grateful you're out there.